Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Stephen Pimpera, host of the Public Policy Channel, and today we are speaking with Doran Taussig, who is the author of What We Mean by the American Dream, Stories We Tell About Meritocracy, new from ILR and Cornell University Press. Doran, thank you for being here.
I'm so happy to be here, Stephen. Thanks for having me.
So if you would, why don't you start by telling us a bit about yourself and how it is that you came to write this book?
Sure. So I was a journalist out of college for the first decade or so of my career. I sort of gradually realized that wasn't for me and made my way over into academia and got into grad school. I was interested initially in grad school in I think something that had interested me in the world of journalism, which is these little summaries that we do to explain who people are, these sort of summary life stories that journalists will do in profiles or even news stories. And, you'll say Mr. Smith grew up here and he did this and now he works here and that kind of thing. And so I initially started studying life stories in graduate school. And as I dug into those, it was around 2012, the presidential election was going on. One of the big themes in that presidential election was the sort of Barack Obama saying, "You didn't build that." There's some, you remember that kerfuffle?
Yeah.
Mitt Romney giving his 47% spiel, or 47% of the people in the country who are, takers and not makers, and, don't want to take responsibility for their own lives. And it just sort of seemed like this was this major fault line in American life, and that people were paying a lot of attention to it at the systemic level, but not as much at this sort of individual life story level that I was interested in. Sort of like when we summarize who a person is, we didn't often explicitly ask just sort of regular people, well, how'd you get here? And do you feel like you earned it? And what does that mean to you? And I thought, with my background in journalism, I feel like I could ask people that question, and that might be interesting.
So you conducted interviews with 60 some odd people, mostly in the Philadelphia area, and then also looked at 30 sort of media narratives about more prominent kinds of people, with this idea of unpacking a little bit about meritocracy. So why don't we start there? Where does that term come from? And what did you think was missing from the way that we use it or the way that we understand the idea?
Sure. Okay. So where the term comes from is really interesting. I don't know who in the audience sort of is familiar with the term meritocracy off the bat. I assure everyone that if you don't know the term meritocracy, you still know the idea meritocracy, right? Meritocracy just means a system where people advance based on their efforts and abilities. So the person who's going to be best at the job gets the job. The person who did the best work that year gets the award, that kind of thing. That's a meritocracy. Now, the term meritocracy actually comes from sort of mid-20th century England. And it was initially a derogatory term. It was a sociologist named Michael Young, who I think actually didn't coin it, but he popularized it, writing a book about this sort of horrific landscape where people only advanced based on their intelligence and talents. And there was all this testing and, you know, rich people would try to adopt the gifted children of working class people because they knew that those people were going to end up ruling society. And he introduced it as a sort of like, we do not want to live in this. And then sort of gradually over the course of the next 50 years, it came to be a positive descriptor of what people in the UK and also here in America wanted to aspire to. We want to be a meritocracy. We want to be a society that rewards merit, which is basically positive qualities that deserve reward, you know, and what we think of when we talk about that in sort of professional context is, you know, it's very often intelligence, but also effort and hard work and other kinds of talents. So now we live in a society where this is an idea that we want to aspire to. In the world that I was sort of immersed in academia and sort of like, you know, let's say left criticism of American culture, there's a lot of cynicism about the idea of meritocracy. Basically, the philosophy about it now is like, we don't live in a meritocracy, but we pretend that we do. And it's a lie that is used to justify inequality, right? Like we've always had different sort of like cultural justifications for inequality. Maybe we used to live in an aristocracy and you inherit your, you know, position. And now we say we live in a meritocracy. And so we're supposed to achieve our positions based on our, you know, positive qualities. And what people, you know, frequently left say is, but we actually don't. And they're right. We don't live in a meritocracy, right? Like, you know, the zip code you grew up in is extremely predictive of your income later in life. But that meritocracy is this lie that Americans buy into that allows us to accept this. And we tell all these stories, these like Horatio Alger stories about people picking themselves up by their bootstraps in order to persuade, you know, the American public that we are a meritocracy. And what I thought was missing was actually asking people, well, how have you experienced your life in this regard? And do you feel like you've lived in a meritocracy? Do you feel like your life has worked that way? What would that really mean to you?
And, you know, what I think there are a couple of things that more than a couple of things, perhaps, that you find that I think are interesting and perhaps surprising, given the way that this national narrative of meritocracy has played out and unfolded. And one is that I think even among those sort of people, myself included, who have been arguing for decades that whatever we mean by merit, that is not a good predictor of people's position in life. As you said, it's literally their parentage and the zip code they were born in continues to be the single best predictor of, say, income over the life course. But we tell this story, but that Americans believe this, right? That we've internalized this notion of the American dream, and that if all you need to do is work hard and play by the rules, and you can right grow up to be anything that you want to be. But one of the first things that I think is interesting and surprising is that almost none of your subjects actually think that we live in a functioning meritocracy. Is that right?
That is right. Now, I got to be careful with this because, you know, there are polls that suggest otherwise. But I think this is the kind of thing where the answer you get is going to really depend on how you ask the question and the context in which you ask the question, right? So if you ask, I imagine it is still the case. I'm not a pollster. Imagine it's the case if you ask most Americans, you know, what matters most, your hard work or your, you know, family and you know, class of origin, they probably still say your hard work, right? And so you could take that and say, okay, so most Americans still believe we live in a meritocracy. But what I was doing is I was having in-depth conversations with people about how their lives worked and how they see life working around them. And that is not what people said. You know, or they certainly didn't say that. They certainly didn't describe the society they were living in as anything approaching a sort of like perfect or, you know, close to accurately functioning meritocracy. you know, people live in the world. They live in the real world. And I think when they look around them, when they ask, like, how did I get here? They understand that it is not just entirely on my own, entirely the fruits of my own efforts and talents. They say, oh, I got such and such lucky break. I had this and such, this and that mentor. My parents pointed me in this direction. What's the difference between me and sort of comparable people? Well, maybe it was, my parents doing this and their parents doing that, and what have you.
So I want to circle back around to that, but I also want to sort of keep our eye on this larger context just for a little bit. As I mentioned earlier, the other piece of your work here is looking at national media stories of prominent people and the ways in which they talk about success. You can't see me, I'm putting that in air quotes.
Sure.
Achievement, right? Success. So what did you observe when you were looking at those kinds of stories? And feel free if you want to jump in and maybe pick a person or two that you think is interesting to think about how those stories, how those narratives play out on the national landscape.
Yeah, sure. No, this is great. And this is important because it really helps to sort of make that point that I maybe wandered away from, which is that American belief that we live in a meritocracy is not so simple and straightforward. And the observation that I make about this is that, you know, that simple story of Americans are told we live in a meritocracy. We hear these Horatio Alger stories and we think we live in a society that's fair, where people achieve based on their merits. Sort of suggests that when we tell stories about our heroes and our very accomplished people, that we make a case that they are in their, you know, high and enviable positions because of their, again, efforts and abilities, because of them, because of things that they did, right? But when you dig into the way we actually tell these stories, we tend not to so much assume that people are in high positions because of their merit as we argue about whether they are in high positions because of their merit, right? I think the most obvious and perhaps unsurprising example of this is politics. You know, if you look at like every presidential campaign, presidential candidates are, selling biographies. I don't mean literally selling biographical books, all they are, but, you know, they make campaign, like biographical campaign ads.
Bill Clinton was the boy from Hope.
Exactly. Yeah. And yeah, went back to Dwight Eisenhower, grew up in the small frame house in Abilene. Right. And so they tell these very sort of like up from humble roots, you know, Lincoln and the log cabin stories. But then the other side objects, you know, like without fail. They say, oh, but they're not really there because of merit, because they grew up rich, or they got such and such lucky break, or they lied and cheated, you know, or they've been rewarded by some flawed, rigged system, you know, like Donald Trump said about Hillary Clinton. And there becomes this back and forth and this profound debate. So one example I go into some detail in the book is Carly Fiorina, who ran for president in 2016 in the Republican primary against Donald Trump. And she had she used this tagline, from secretary to CEO. You know, she had been a CEO, and she said, and this tagline sort of evokes, again, this humble roots, you know, up from nothing by her bootstraps narrative. And the Washington Post wrote a column, a fact-checking column, saying essentially, well, this isn't really true. She was a secretary, but it was like a college summer job or something. And her dad was like the Duke of the Dean of Duke's Law School, you know, like a sort of a very, you know, prominent family. And that she was always on a trajectory to be something other than a secretary. And so that the story she was evoking wasn't true. And, you know, we could talk about, there's some interesting stuff there about like the role of the fact checker and that kind of thing. But the point I wanted to sort of highlight there is that like the real content of the sort of public discourse about Carly Fiorina was not a Horatio Alger story. It was a debate over to what extent she met the ideal of meritocracy, right? So it's not like simply treating her as meritocratic. It's asking the question and then like trying to take a measurement. And another thing I find sort of really striking about this is that, so, you know, if we look at sort of different, you know, maybe this is just me, I don't think so. If we look at sort of different sectors and say, where do we expect the sort of most meritocratic sort of processes to be in place, I'd look at sports, right? Because anybody could argue that, you know, somebody besides Carly Fiorina would make a better president or presidential candidate. It'd be very hard to argue that, like, Serena Williams shouldn't be in the top seed of the U.S. Open, you know? It feels like we have a more objective measurement there. But even in our profiles of star athletes, there's this question of whether they deserve to be where they are, right? Because the meaning of merit is sort of a fluid and unclear concept. And so people will say, like, well, sure, LeBron's a great basketball player, but, like, look at the genetic lottery he won, right? And so how much work has he really put into that? And does he deserve the rewards that he's getting? Shaquille O'Neal is actually a really great example of that kind of thing. Because he's sort of, you know, like, just the biggest, strongest person on the planet, and didn't seem terribly invested in you know, improving beyond his ability to completely dominate without a lot of effort. And so there's a lot of, like, well, does Shaq deserve to be Shaq?
And, you know, always, and there's implicit in that, of course, the assumption that anyone can deserve to have that kind of wealth, have that kind of fame, have that kind of prominence, right? And the other thing, and maybe this is the segue into talking into some of those individual narratives, is that, as you've just described it, right, we've got really sort of muddy and messy and complicated ways that we, as in the U.S., sort of our culture is it's messy, right? The way that we think about this. Can you say a little bit more about that, and then maybe sort of talk about how this played out in your interviews with less prominent and famous people as they tried to make sense of their own lives and how they explain where they are and why?
So do you want me to say more about how it's muddy and messy? I mean, you mentioned the sort of the assumption that deserving something is possible. And I would say that is where the idea of meritocracy really does have its hooks in American culture, right? At least based on my interviews, is the assumption not that we live in a meritocracy, not that any individual achieved things, you know, purely meritocratically, but that we could and should live in a meritocracy.
And that is the thing that we should be aspiring to, even if we're not there yet.
That's right. And that we should work toward this. This is a coherent idea. And that in individual cases, it makes some sense to sort of try to evaluate how close individuals come to this ideal, and that if they come sort of close enough, that's a good thing. That's associated with human dignity in American society, right? Is being able to say, I earned it.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
So let's turn to your interviews. And there's sort of so much rich material there. Maybe you're a better judge of where to start than I am, but is there, what do you want to say about what are the things that you still sort of keep in your head about the most striking kinds of patterns about the ways in which people responded to your questions about, you know, where they are, how do they describe where they are, how do they explain why they got there, whether they feel like successes or failures. Mm-hmm. What did you learn about how people think about those kinds of questions?
So I think an interesting place to start is with the idea of advantage, or, you know, what sort of we conversationally now call privilege. You know, this is an important point in a lot of, you know, really American discourse and you know, left discourse particularly is, you know, like, are you aware of your advantage? Do you acknowledge your advantage? These kinds of things. And something I expected going in based on sort of like things I'd read was that people who enjoyed a substantial advantage or even a sort of noteworthy advantage were going to deny it. That's what I sort of anticipated. And that's not what I saw. What I saw instead is that, you know, when people sort of described, and I guess I should offer as a caveat, I don't know what people didn't tell me because I wasn't doing like research on their lives beyond their interviews, but people would sort of very, very openly say, yeah, I came, you know, I come from like this really good family, and they've supported me and they paid for my college. And that was like really helpful. And I had so much more than so many other people. People readily acknowledged these kinds of things. And then what becomes interesting is what they do with that in relationship to the question of whether they've earned what they have. So, you know, most of the people who felt like they'd had something of a head start in life had ended up in a successful position, which is not terribly surprising based on the statistics you're talking about earlier about, you know, zip codes and whatnot. And so, okay, so you feel this, you had this substantial advantage and now you're in a good place. So do you feel like you earned that good place? And for the most part, the answer is yes. And there are reasons that people offer for that are interesting and I think sort of make some sense, which is what a lot of people would say is, yeah, you know, because I feel like I did the right things with my advantage, right? So, yeah, I got to go to these really good schools and my parents paid for college, but I worked hard within that context. And so, you know, I feel like I earned it. And what that is sort of telling me is that when people evaluate whether they as individuals earned what they have, they just want to say, well, what did I do? Right? They want to evaluate themselves because this is an individual question that's going to speak to their individual dignity. They don't want to hold themselves accountable for factors outside of their control, like that they grew up in a middle or upper middle class family. And you know, that makes some sense. That makes a lot of sense. You know, I want to think about my own life that way, but it's not meritocratic, right? Because if I have a huge advantage over you and then I end up in a better position, if you and I, Stephen, like apply for the same job and my uncle is the boss and I end up getting the job, it doesn't matter that I try really hard. I mean, I'm sorry. it's great that then I try really hard and do a really good job in the job.
Yeah.
But I didn't earn the job in a meritocratic sense vis-a-vis your opportunities. You know, I maybe earned it in a sort of like more individual sort of like a sense that only speaks to my own human dignity. So what I'm seeing there is that the standards people are using to evaluate whether they deserve things and earn things in their own lives are not, in fact, meritocratic standards. They're something else. The other thing I noticed about people talking about advantages is that people have this tendency to ask, like, well, was my advantage unreasonable, right? And there's this sort of, people didn't say this explicitly, but I sort of tried to suss this out based on the kind of things people told me. There's this question people ask implicitly about, like, is my advantage something that a lot of people have or that people should have? One guy I talked to said, I was born on second base. I don't know if you're a baseball fan, but this is like an old quip from, I forget who, about one of the
like,
Bushes. Richards.
Ann Richards, thank you, former governor of Texas, talking about George W. Bush, said he was born on third base and thought he hit a home run.
Right, exactly. And the implication there is that you didn't have to do anything. Somebody has sack fly and you scored and you think you did something awesome, right? So born on second base implies to me like, yeah, it's a bit of a head start, but like I still have to sort of like, you know, run hard and pay attention. And I feel like I got that feeling from a lot of people. They felt they were born on second base and that like they could still sort of grant themselves the dignity of deservedness given that condition. One story I tell that I think is useful for sort of understanding this dynamic is this this lawyer I interviewed, who he was like some corporate attorney, and wearing a fancy suit when he met me, you know, and he was a good position in life. He liked his job. And I said, do you feel like you've earned where you are? And he said, yeah, I do. You know, I'm smart and I worked hard. And then I said, well, do you feel like we live in a meritocracy? And he said, no, which is not in and of itself surprising. When I said, why? And he said, well, these women that I work with, they are smarter than me and they work harder than me, but our bosses are sexists. And so I get opportunities, I get promotions that they don't get. And this sort of stopped me and made me think like, well, if you and these women are competing for the same promotions and you're getting them because of sexist bosses, how can you deserve to be where you are? And the answer is because he's not asking, do I deserve it based on a pure meritocracy? He's asking, did I do the right thing given the sort of playing field that was laid out in front of me? And I don't think that's a crazy thing for him to think individually, but it does sort of raise some questions about then how we, you know, organize society and what we aspire to in terms of like building toward a meritocracy at the societal level.
You know, I also wonder, this is a little bit outside the four corners of your book, but I wonder, you know, how much of this is in some ways in sort of a reaction to cognitive dissonance and justification for not doing super hard things, right? Because at some level, if you recognize I have had these advantages and they have made it possible for me to live a very different kind of life than other people lead, and the world is filled with people who have worked just as hard or harder as I have, but haven't seen the benefits from that, and that's wrong. The implication of that is, and therefore I now need to work to alter those systems to create greater fairness. And that's just not stuff that most people are interested in or up for.
I think there's truth to that. I also think it's stuff that's like, you know, a really difficult proposition for somebody who's in a workaday job, you know,
yeah,
to be like, I'm going to go alter the systems that determine, you know, most people, yeah, are just going to work and doing the best that they can. And again, given that we live in a society that says that, like, you know, a lot, not all, but a lot of your dignity is based on, you know, being able to sort of to say, I earned my professional position.
Yeah.
You don't want to deny yourself that dignity based on things you couldn't control. That is a form of cognitive dissonance, and I understand why people duck it.
Yeah, I mean, you point out a couple of instances, maybe sort of the most extreme and arguably absurd case of this is somebody like Ivanka Trump, right? Sort of straining to make the case that she has merited the government positions that she held, which, you know, maybe this is my own bias showing, but I don't think stands up to too much scrutiny.
No, it clearly doesn't, and I think that in cases like that, I think, you know, most reasonable people can look at it and say that's ridiculous. But I also think that it's sort of reflective of the flexibility and fluidity of these definitions. If even Ivanka Trump can make a case, right, you know, that she's earned it, then we don't have very clear sort of cultural standards for this.
Yeah. So did no one really suggest, you phrased this differently and I don't have it directly in front of me, but you suggested that no one suggested that they actually hadn't lived up to their potential. Am I getting that right?
No one suggested they hadn't lived up to their potential?
That they had... Give me 2 seconds. Let me
see
if I can.
No. I think I know what you're thinking of.
Here we go. No interviewees said anything to the effect of, quote, "I should have done better considering how smart I am." So that's slightly different than the way I phrased
it. So what that is about, and this is an interesting thing to talk about because I think it's another sort of really complicated wrinkle in all this, is talent, right? And our relationship to the idea of talent. Because this is like a really big sort of leg on the stool of my argument that like that what we talk about when we talk about deserving things is different from the meritocratic version of deserving things, right? So in a meritocracy, if I'm just super talented and don't try very hard, that doesn't matter. I should still get the job. I should still get the reward. I'm just the best for the job, right? But when you ask people what does it mean to deserve something and who earns things, talent doesn't factor in very prominently. We want to think about, again, things within people's control. What are the choices that they made? How much effort did they put out? Now, I mean, we could get really philosophical if you want and ask whether those things matter too. But the sort of like colloquial understanding of these concepts in American life is that like, talent is something you're born with, and then you make choices about making effort and making decisions, and that speaks more to your agency, right? And we're really uncomfortable with the idea that talent determines a lot. Because if talent determines a lot, then that's not meritocracy, right? That's not really merited. That's not earned. When I asked people about so one thing that's interesting is when I asked people, well, how'd you get where you are? What are the important factors? People would, you know, they'd tell me a story and they'd talk about people who helped them and they talk about sort of structural factors in their lives, the class they grew up in, they talk about different breaks that they had, and they would talk about efforts and decisions, and they tended not to talk about talent. And I had to ask a lot of people, well, what about talent, right? What about your sort of natural abilities? And then I would get things, I would get answers like, well, I'm mechanically inclined, or I'm good with numbers, or I'm a people person, and that kind of thing. And what I'm saying, nobody said anything like, I'm really smart, you know, I'm extreme. Nobody described themselves as having sort of exceptional abilities. The passage you're talking about here, you know, people would sort of, people can treat talent as a sort of like starting point based on which they can measure their, you know, achievement and what they accomplish. But nobody said anything quite like, listen, I'm really smart and I've let myself down in that regard. We seem to try to minimize, and I should say, I don't have any like, specific insight into how important talent actually is, you know, in people's lives. But what I can say is that when we tell stories, people seem to want to avoid the question.
So as we work our way toward concluding here, you finish up thy book by talking about four narratives that you think might be useful for us to hear more. Could you walk us through some or all of those that you think would help us, what sort of bridge the divide that you have been pointing to in our thinking about this question? What are the ways we should be shifting the way that we tell stories about merit or deservingness or meritocracy?
Sure. So let me say, as a sort of preface to that, that, you know, it's a hard question when you start to say, like, well, the problem is not that we believe we live in a meritocracy, it's that we have this meritocratic ideal. Well, then you got to figure out, well, what do you want instead of that? Because, you know, I'm I have kids. My 10-year-old right now is in the process, has just gone through like this process in a baseball league, and there's like all-star tryouts. I'm like, there's not a better way to decide who's on that team than the coaches try to pick the best players. You know, there is a lot that is sort of intuitive and healthy about having some meritocratic standards. Like, you want a qualified person to be your electrician or surgeon. You know, you want the kid with the strong arm to play quarterback. You know, right. So there's a lot to sort of recommend that, and so I'm not sort of like all in on like fully deconstructing everything about the meritocratic ideal. So what I'm trying to do is figure out, like, well, how can we tell stories about how people get to where they are that doesn't like object to those things entirely, that doesn't discourage effort in life, but still pushes for like a softer meritocracy that acknowledges the incoherence and inevitable shortcomings of like meritocratic systems, right? That there's always going to be an act of God. There's always going to be lucky breaks. And how can we just sort of how can we tell stories that encourage us to make people's lives better, not just by leveling the playing field and trying to get closer to a perfect meritocracy, but by admitting that we're not going to have a perfect meritocracy. So how do we have a good life anyway, right? And some of the storylines that I suggest to do that are, one, acknowledging that people can succeed and fail, not just as individuals, but as parts of groups. So one thing that people do a lot in telling their stories, and we as Americans do, is we sort of try to isolate the individual in their trajectory. We try to say, like, well, who was the star of that team? Who really carried that team forward? And what did Serena Williams do on her own without her father's, what's really Serena in there? You know, like that kind of thing. And I think that we could do that less. We could just sort of acknowledge that people succeed as parts of groups and communities, and they fail that way too. And that's okay. We don't always have to figure out like what the individual's role in that is. Another one is, I think that we should be more open to the idea that talent is really important. We should feel less awkward about that. There's this really, I think, interesting, and I haven't decided if I think it's fully sort of hypocritical or whatever, but there's a tendency that we think that saying that you have talent is really, you know, egotistical and obnoxious.
It's immodest. One doesn't do that, right?
Yeah. But people talk about how hard they work all the time.
Right.
And what's interesting is that actually we really value hard work in American society, and we're really uncomfortable with the idea of talent. It should be hard work. Bragging about how hard you work should be the immodest thing.
Right.
Right. And so I think that just sort of being more open about the possibility that talent determines certain things would be useful. Now, there are dangers there for sure. But it's another thing we should sort of yeah, be more open to. Another thing is that, like, I think, and I come back to Carly Fiorina for this. A lot of the attacks on Carly Fiorina after she, you know, came out with this secretary for CEO line were sort of these, no, you didn't really earn it because of such and such advantages. And this is a pretty common sort of line of attack and line of argument when you want to sort of tear somebody down in American society, talk about how they didn't earn their position. But part of what that kind of line of attack does is it reinforces the premise that it's possible for someone to earn it. It's possible for someone to sort of like be a true realization of meritocracy. And so what I suggest is that more of these sorts of critiques should be less about like you specifically didn't earn it. We're not sometimes in a meritocracy or almost in a meritocracy. We're not in a meritocracy except for such and such violations. We're not in a meritocracy, you know, and we're probably not going to be, and we don't need to sort of keep on reinforcing the premise that some people can, you know, can represent that sort of true bootstraps story. And the last one is luck. It is just like it is acknowledging and being more comfortable with the role of lucky breaks in determining things, that luck doesn't need to be necessarily explained away or apologized for. It is an inevitable part of life. And we should just like, work on integrating that it is so frequently now treated in stories as this sort of exception to the rule of how things work. No. It's the luck is how things work.
And you talked earlier and writing the book about the Rachel Alger stories, but I had occasion a number of years ago to go back and actually read a bunch of those. Every one of those stories that I remember, the turning point is actually happenstance. It's a bit of luck. It's a bit of fortune. It's a deus ex machina, right? So it's we've even internalized those stories as, and you know, part of that narrative is, you know, street urchin does the following things and rises to commanding heights. But there is always this turning point that is precisely that. It's chance, it's luck, it's the intervention of fate. And we've erased that from this story that we think reflects the way that we understand mobility in the United States. But even that doesn't. We've so contorted our thinking around this.
Well, so I think what actually happens there, we didn't get a chance to get into this, but the thing about the way people use luck in their stories is it's not entirely unlike the way they use privilege in their stories. Is we say like, okay, we're going to acknowledge it, but then we're going to figure out a way to put it back on the individual, right? Right.
So I took advantage of it. Sure, I got lucky, but then here's what I did with that luck.
So there's the cliche of I made my own luck, and then there's the exactly what you're saying, like, but I reacted to it the right way. There's almost like a sort of a quasi-statistical philosophy about luck, because like if you get bad luck, you know, you just got to keep trying and eventually your luck turns, or if you get good luck, you have to capitalize on that at that moment. And what we don't do is make luck the star of the story, right? We try to find some way to have luck be this external factor that somebody then, exactly like you're saying in the Horatio Alger story, has to capitalize and sort of do the right thing with. But like luck can be determinant, right? That is what we tend not to sort of
But of course, if we acknowledge that, and maybe this is where we should end, is that that requires that we rethink the economy, the political system, and the welfare state, right? It's like, oh, wait, if this really is just happenstance, whether some people eat and other people don't, maybe we then need to erect systems that control for that. And that's a much more complicated enterprise, obviously.
Yeah, but that's the idea. And, you know, I mean, you're a policy guy, Stephen. Most of my, you know, my book has like a page of policy in it.
Yeah.
What I view it as doing, I hope, is like offering a different frame for making some of these same policy interventions that people like you have been fighting for a long time, which is, you know, the big picture sort of liberalism and to some extent the left of the United States has been for a long time now saying, well, we don't live in a meritocracy and that is why we need to fix things and make things a level playing field. But that keeps on sort of reiterating this premise that we could live in a meritocracy. Right. And I think the frame we need to start advancing is not just like we need to level the playing field, but just like we just need to make life better regardless. Because exactly like you're saying, yeah, luck is determinant in a lot of cases, and it's always going to be, right? That doesn't mean we shouldn't try to level the playing field. That would be better, right? But yes, we have to sort of rethink these systems of distribution if we want to have a society that approaches anything close to justice. Because of this sort of profound role of luck.
You have been listening to the Public Policy Channel of the New Books Network, and we have been speaking with Doran Taussig, who's the author of What We Mean by the American Dream, Stories We Tell About Meritocracy from ILR and Cornell University Press. Doran, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Steve.